One in five Americans has learned a new language on their bucket list, or life backlog, if you will. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Upgrade your personal skill set in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Its tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and deliver with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I have a trip to Mexico coming up, so I've been using Babbel to brush up on my Spanish. The courses are short and sweet, so I can do one whenever I have a few minutes to spare. And the words and phrases it teaches you are designed for practical, real-world use, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions. Babbel can even provide you feedback on your pronunciation with its speech recognition tech. And it's not just for Spanish. Babbel includes 14 different language courses, each backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for Scoop Nation. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/gamescoop. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/gamescoop, spelled BABBEL.com/gamescoop. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN Game Scoop. I'm not Damon Hatfield. I'm Tina Amini, sitting in for Damon Hatfield. And joining me this week are Samuel Claiborne.
Hey, everybody.
Justin Davis.
Scoop.
And special first-time appearance, our senior news editor, Kat Bailey. Welcome, Kat.
Hello, everybody. Excited to be invading another podcast here over at IGN.
We're slowly getting to all of them for you. It's going to be real cat scoop this week, a genuine cat scoop. We've got a great show for you this week, if I may say so myself. A lot of movement happening in the video game industry. Lots of new or perhaps just formalized collaborations, potentially bringing in lots of new possibilities down the road. First up, earlier this week, Sony announced their acquisition of Housemarque, the developer behind the most recently known for Returnal, of course, which was released just a few months ago now, exclusively to the PS5. Bit of a trend there, to much critical as well as Damey praise. They were pretty light on the details of exactly what that new structure would tangibly mean for Housemarque, but both the co-founder and managing director of Housemarque, Ilari Kuitunen, and the head of PlayStation Studios, Herman Hulst, spoke to Collaboration several times in an interview with British GQ, and they also spoke to the technology behind Housemarque games. They both mentioned it as a pillar of the studio, essentially. And I wanted to spend time talking about what we make of that. But then just this morning, they also announced a new acquisition with Nixxis Software. So real quick from our news report from Joe Screvels, Nixxis has worked extensively with Crystal Dynamics, Eidos Montreal, and IO Interactive since forming in 1999, porting the recent Tomb Raider trilogy and the two most recent Deus Ex games to PC. While no specifics have been given about Nixxis's work for PlayStation, it feels likely that the studio will support Sony's increased focus on porting its console exclusives games to PC. So there's a bit of a trend here, aside from just the acquisitions, but there's a lot of technical know-how coming in from these two new studios. So what's our reaction to the news?
One thing that I know people really like Housemarque because they've made these kind of like small boutique games that like are associated with Sony. Like I think Resogun was the one that I first remember, even though they had stuff before that. But people love that stuff. And because it's like these kind of twitchy arcadey games, and then, you know, that type of studio is, of course, like totally my jam. I love stuff like that. And one cool thing that they've done is they've worked with like old arcade devs like Eugene Jarvis on these old games, which I thought was really neat. And so that's why Returnal, when that came out, was like such a huge, crazy leap into, you know, AAA like game design for them. And then everybody loved it. So it's like, you can see why Sony's just like, they built up loyalty among like Sony fans, and then they made this big, huge game. It's like, what a great gift for them. It's just, everything just checks all the boxes, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, Returnal also plays homage to, you know, to Super Stardust and to Resogun, right? Where it is like like there's some parallel universe of video games or like bullet hell shooters where the thing that took off for like the last 30 years and then Returnal is just the latest iteration of that, because there is a lot of like, you know, dodging and ducking around the enemy bullet waves that are coming at you. You know, it's great. It's just awesome to see somebody take a different vision of what like a big AAA game can be, and kudos to them for tying the knot with Sony.
Yeah, Returnal is one of my favorite games of 2021. And when I played it, I was like, thank God we've finally gotten past the cover-based shooter with its kind of start and stop, very slow, very deliberate cadence. No offense to people who enjoy those types of games, but I just much prefer the kind of the twitchy action that Returnal and Doom offer. And frankly, Housemarque is really, really good at that style of game. The thing with Housemarque is if you want to kind of have an idea of how this might play out for them, just look at Insomniac, which has just been a huge win for Sony since their acquisition. It wasn't too long ago that Insomniac was in some real trouble. They had a really bad time, for example, with EA. A lot of their games weren't doing super well. And then they kind of came out of the wilderness with Spider-Man. And ever since, Insomniac has just vaulted toward the kind of the top of the rankings in terms of blockbuster studios. And it seems like the same could be done for Housemarque.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to say Herman Holsta, you know, head of PlayStation Studios, was kind of alluding to what that might look like for Housemarque, in the sense of they hold forums. They're very much about sharing resources or intel amongst their developers. So they spoke a little bit to Housemarque is now providing, like, they have their own visual effects engine, and Larry Quintanen was speaking about that as well. And so I think that their contribution is on the technical end, which sounds like a similar perspective from Nixxis software that we just heard about this morning from the recording on Thursday. So it seems like the idea is that kind of collaborative nature, and Herman Holst was also speaking to, when they're looking at acquisitions, that's the angle they're going for. You're genuinely coming into a network, into a family of developers meant to hold conferences to educate one another, or even genuinely just borrow from each other's development studios. And they also spoke to how now being able to focus on one platform would give them an opportunity to think about and spend more of their focus on some of those other elements and some of their aspirations for where they want to take the future of their games coming into this new AAA territory they're in.
And yeah, Housemarque is a studio that is consistently punched above its own weight. Last I checked, it had about 80 people on its development team. It might have scaled up a bit more for Returnal. That's really impressive considering the quality of the game that it put out. I mean, Returnal had its share of technical problems, but by and large, it's one of the most beautiful games on the platform. I was shocked when I was playing it. And so with the resources that Sony should be able to give them, I really expect Housemarque's next project to be like kind of blow the doors off.
Mm-hmm. See, I kind of hope they go the other direction and we get a Super Stardust HD sequel.
I don't think they're going to do that, small though. Games.
Yeah.
The sad thing is they're like, we're done with that. Like when Returnal came out, they gave an interview and said, you know, we did the arcade thing. It was great. Mm-hmm. We had a good time with it, but it's time to move on to bigger and better games. And there was some sadness from people who kind of wish that we could have more big time developers who would follow that particular path. But for Housemarque, I think they just are seeing themselves moving on to the next step. And I respect that. Returnal is not your bog standard AAA blockbuster game. It's very Housemarque in the way that it uses particle effects, the way that the action moves and everything. And I expect their next game to have a similar stamp of their identity.
Traditionally when companies have moved on from making arcade games, they went into making mascot platformers and JRPGs and 90s fighters, but they skipped all that and went straight to contemporary 3D games.
Mm-hmm. That's what coming into the PlayStation history family joke. Does for you.
Mm-hmm. There's always more and more, you know, another 8-person team can pick up the mantle of making, you know, a spiritual successor to Stardust HD. I was looking at, they've been locked up, you alluded to this earlier, Tina, that they've been locked up with Sony for so long that, you know, some people, like, that was the news wasn't shocking or surprising at all. It was just sort of making official a business partnership that had long been in place. Mm-hmm. The last game that they released that was not released, it did eventually get ported to the Vita, but wasn't initially released on a Sony platform, was a mobile game called Furman's, a cute little physics puzzler. And I was looking
at it. Did you review it?
Yes. No. I was looking up information about it, and I found my own writings about that game.
I love cool. it when that happens.
It's just yeah. self-educating.
Yeah, back point. In 2012. So for 9 years, they've been they did do some work for Activision and stuff in the meantime, but everything that they released has been on a PlayStation platform since.
They did like an isometric shooter. They probably did several of them, but I think there this was called Alien Storm or something, Alien Syndicate, something like that. And it was a I looked at it and I was like, I think I reviewed that game, and then I looked it up and somebody else had reviewed it, but I thought I did and I didn't just like it at the time. It was 2010. It was a long time ago.
There's still a chance to re-review it.
Yeah, yeah. Or maybe I did the sequel or something. I just was really confused. I was like, I'm pretty sure.
But yes, it does seem like, at least according to Housemarque's co-founder in the interview with British GQ, it does seem like, as he says, when we're thinking about the future titles, they'll maybe be even bigger and even more ambitious. So it doesn't seem like they're going to be coming backwards into the roots of some of those smaller arcade-like games. But who knows? Perhaps in these forums, they'll be passing on and educating to other developers and giving them some ideas of ways to incorporate some of their well-known kind of genre and style of development.
Yeah, they could take on a Sony license. I mean, that's what's really cool, right? Is that they could be given like some cool license to resurrect or do the next game in. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, well, Kat's right. Like, you know, all goofing on Super Stardust aside, like just a different vision of what a AAA game can be. Like, I always really appreciate that. And even though, you know, Returnal wasn't necessarily my thing, mainly because of the, I just wish it was linear. But the actual moment-to-moment gameplay, it's fantastic to see somebody take that budget and that approach and that AAA mindset and then not do, like, it's not a very safe game. It's a pretty risky, interesting, unique game, which I really place a premium on at this point in my life.
Just the fact that it's basically a roguelite, really has that kind of indie kind of vibe toward it, and just the way that the structure is handled. And we were all kind of waiting for a game like Returnal to come out. So it's kind of opening the door for a kind of an exciting approach to game development. The thing that I'm most interested, though, is when it comes to the acquisition of Housemarque, is Sony's acquisition strategy going forward. One of the things that happened when Housemarque was announced was it seemed as if Sony accidentally teased the acquisition of Bluepoint as well, which is something that seems inevitable given their close partnership with Sony.
They did like the Shadow of the Colossus port and just kind of are working their way through some of that type. They did another port too for Sony, right?
And Dark Souls. Or Demon Souls.
Demon Souls last year. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In partnership with
Rumors say working on another revival of an interesting game.
Yeah, so that is the interesting strategy, Kat. I was wondering about that a lot as well, because now we're getting a little bit of insight into maybe the unfolding of some other news to come. And there's this consistency between studios that they've already had, they already have developing relationships with, and then studios with technological prowess. And you know, when we're talking about Nixxis Software, because they're accustomed to doing ports, especially to PC, and that's been an often requested feature or rather part of the ecosystem when it comes to PlayStation games. It does feel like there are some intentional steps forward here, both with partners that they have these familiar relationships with, but also could potentially take them to the next level that you know, people have been asking for quite some time.
I think Nintendo proceeds the same way. A lot of the acquisitions they've done have been that kind of close partnership for a while, and then they're like, you're ours now. And I mean, it's funny when the opposite of that happened with Rare. But that's Microsoft's totally different strategy, right? Is that they snatched up a lot of developers, you know, like especially over the past 3 years. And it's been hard to tell like where they were going with that, you know, like it's just been like get really good, talented people instead of like these kind of go-tos that they've been working with.
Yeah, it feels a little bit less unified and sort of building a brick by brick strategy and more just like playing a little bit of catch up just because Microsoft first party studios weren't quite as prolific as Sony first party studios were.
Yeah, and you know, Kat, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think for Sony in the last decade, you know, their previous acquisition before this was Insomniac, as we were speaking to earlier in 2019, and for the last decade, it's been Insomniac and then Housemarque, and now really feels like the floodgates are beginning to open where that strategy is being renewed, but it's in stark contrast to the Xbox strategy of late.
Well, I think Sony really wants to keep building up its first-party studios because as was alluded to in a piece about PlayStation Indies just today, Sony mm-hmm. has just put a huge premium on AAA, big budget games that will really like push the PS5 to the absolute limits. And you can just see it in the logo, which every game starts up with a kind of a Marvel style logo of being like, look at all of our first party IPs. And they're mm-hmm. doing that with Insomniac, and now they're doing that with Housemarque. So
that's a great comparison. I like that.
Yeah. I think Marvel every time I see that freaking logo.
Yeah. It totally is worth it. They totally cribbed that from there. Mm-hmm.
Well, in other new collaboration news, Remedy also announced a Control multiplayer spin-off game. It's codenamed Condor. It is going to be a four-player co-op player versus environment game, which actually feels pretty apt considering the universe and the experience of Control. The development is going to be split between Remedy and 505 Games, who, reminder, published Control. And then notable in the story is that the initial development budget is cited at 25 million euros, which will be split between the two studios. And that's approximately the same budget as Control, which was cited at just around 30 million euros. Obviously, it's difficult to make a comparison when we're talking about a single-player game and a multiplayer game. You know, for a multiplayer, Remedy as a studio has been increasingly ramping up their staff. But in general, when you're working on a multiplayer game, you need multiplayer specific programmers, and you need to be thinking about, you know, are we going to be using character modding and interchangeable assets for being able to, like, you know, do different weapons or, you know, decorating your characters, like whatever involvement there might be there could potentially impact like what that budget means. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to make a scale comparison, but I still want to. And obviously they're going to inevitably be reusing models, characters, textures, and probably basic player mechanics. So at least they're not starting from scratch there. But it's an interesting new territory for Remedy in general to be heading into this multiplayer kind of experience.
Yeah, and it's also exploring, they're returning to a universe. Like, they just don't do stuff like that. And to, you know, expand that universe, you know, beyond Alan Wake and Control, which are now officially tied together. That's an official thing, which is really funny. That's just, it's super cool. I think that there's people on our staff that love Control for its vibe and its universe and its characters and like everything that was built out. And it was received very well, quote unquote, in office when Control was expanded. I think that's, people are really excited for that.
Remedy and then has something that everybody desperately wants, would kill for, which is a brand new IP that is very popular. It's a real breakout hit. And now Remedy is doing what a lot of studios want to do, which is leverage it as much as humanly possible. And you can argue with that and be like, oh, geez, another studio that was kind of a fun mid-tier studio just doing the big budget blockbuster thing. But hey, whatever you got to do to keep going. And I think Remedy is a quality outfit. So I'm really glad that Control's been a hit for them. And just looking at that concept art that they put out for the multiplayer game, it looks like it's going to have the same kind of sense of humor that mm-hmm. Control had. And they were shouting out 90s multiplayer games, which gives me a lot of hope, I think. I think mm-hmm. it'll be very much in the spirit of Control.
Mario Party. That's what they're
doing. GoldenEye.
Yeah. Of course.
I mean, that gets my attention, obviously, a lot more. I am one of those folks that, like you, Kat, like, I wish that Remedy was doing something else and focused on something else. I'm not personally interested in playing this game, although I sort of acknowledge why, as you say, like, you know, you don't always have the luxury of taking a risk with, you know, game after game after game. And if one of them really lands and takes off, you know, you kind of have a requirement almost to your staff to lean into it, at least to some degree. But you know, like, this isn't something anybody was asking for, so I don't know, I guess we'll see. Like, I'll go into it with an open mind, but it's when I saw the news, my reaction was just kind of like, oh, huh, like, that's weird.
I do like how they said, like, listen, we're Remedy. Like, we're going to make our own multiplayer game. Like, trust us. I thought that was kind of cool, because that means that, like, they know that they have a style and a kind of reputation to uphold in what I would describe as, like, weirdness and uniqueness and, like, stuff like that. I think that's a cool thing. And I am reassured by that. They also said they're working on a Control sequel directly, too. So,
yeah,
mm-hmm. I think we're going to get, have the cake and eat it too in this situation. And it'll the cake will be like some super weapon that works into like some triangle reality.
An alien that will kill you.
Yeah, they said that they're actually working on about like six or so other projects in total, including two
just
that are
six
set
or
in
so?
The just six or so. That's why they've been staffing up. But yeah, two should be set in the Control Alan Wake universe, and they did tease like certain of those elements, so they've been kind of threading that connection from the start. I think they just, you know, like elements of the world, and they do in a supernatural way connect. But yeah, Justin, if it makes you feel better, there'll be possibly four others that could not be Control related. Possibly. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I really like, you know, this is the Max Payne studio, right? Like, I think myself, like a lot of folks have a soft spot for Remedy. And, you know, Alan Wake was a sort of cult classic, but never really broke through. And Quantum Break was the same thing. Like, didn't really break through in a big way. And so, you know, I'm happy for them for sort of breaking through with a hit. Like, it's been a while, so it's awesome. And they're another studio, actually not that different than Housemarque, that like has a little bit of a different vision for what like a big AAA action game should be. And I do always appreciate that. I still just can't shake the feeling. This feels like a very Capcom Resident Evil thing to do. It's like, what?
Oh yeah,
that's what it could end up being. Honestly, is if they don't kind of put the budget into it and it ends up being a weird side project, yeah, it could be a very Resident Evil Mercenaries thing. But on the other hand, there are fans of Resident Evil Mercenaries out there. Please don't be mad at me.
There's of course, the Konami following that same pattern. I think the only Metal Gear games we'll get from here on out are going to be weird multiplayer games.
Yeah, I honestly forgot about that weird spinoff. No, but you're right, Tina, that they're saying the right things at the outset. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, and to the multiplayer reassurances that Sam, you were alluding to before, I have the quote here from the game's director, which is, "We get there is going to be skepticism about multiplayer, but I believe we can create shared experiences without compromising the unique DNA of who we are or the stories we want to tell. Yes, we need to rethink our angles, our techniques, our mindsets, but we see it as an exciting challenge. What would a Remedy multiplayer game look like?" Which is fair enough. You know, them diving into and flexing into another territory could count for a really unique multiplayer experience based on how we've seen them take their own unique approach to single player games.
Yeah. I mean, they're a game of the year developer. Like, let's see what they do. That's super cool.
Yeah. Our game of the year developer.
Yep. And do you think they're for sale?
Well, they have another
coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Circling like buzzards. Just watch out for Phil Spencer's shelf. Like, the second that something from Control shows up, we're all in trouble.
Look out for like a clear red polygon just floating and rotating behind him.
Yeah, he probably has bigger problems if that's the case.
I mean, honestly, after playing Control, the shelf itself is the clue, right? Some like mundane shelf in the background. I mean, that's the only thing you blow up in that game.
That's true. More than anybody else, it would be an object of interest, or I forget the exact name for it.
Yeah. Yes. What was it? Yeah. Object of Power? I can't remember.
Object of Power, actually. That sounds right. That sounds more like a Remedy title.
Twin Peaks.
Yeah. Well, in even more partnership announcements, Konami announced a strategic cooperation agreement where they'll be jointly, quote, jointly developing selected contents and exchanging know-how with Bloober, obviously the team behind the Medium. So they'll certainly be developing games together, that much we know. And this is all coming off the heels of rumors, or perhaps more so speculation, around a Silent Hill game in development. And in a Game Industry Biz interview back in February, Bloober team had said that they were working on another horror IP with a very famous publisher. So, of course, the internet has scrambled together to decide that it was likely to be a Silent Hill project. So how do we feel about Bloober being the next team behind one of the Silent Hill projects that are rumored to be in development?
Eh. No offense to Bloober team, but like, if you look at their previous games, they've all been kind of lightly received horror games. I'm not surprised that that Konami targeted Bloober for a potential Silent Hill game, because Bloober borrowed so much from Silent Hill in making the Medium, down to the fact that it had Silent Hill's composer. So they've obviously been inspired by Silent Hill. They were going for that vibe, and Konami said, oh, why not? I will say that Bloober did a pretty good job with technology on the Xbox Series X, and it was a good-looking game. So I guess we'll see. I guess it's one of those situations where it's like, I hope it ends up being good, but Bloober is very much in a kind of prove it mode with this franchise, which, by the way, there's so much pressure because Silent Hill is such a beloved series and it went on hiatus. A lot of people felt that Konami kind of did Silent Hill dirty 10 years ago. And so if Silent Hill returns and it's not all that, there's going to be a lot of frustration, I think. So good luck to Bloober if this ends up being the case.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never liked Silent Hill as much as Resident Evil. Well, I don't like spookies at all anymore. But like, it's fine.
Justin, watch out! They're coming for you.
You know what?
Zombies.
Fighting words.
They can call the cops. If you look at that library of games, they are as bad as they are good. So you know, Silent Hill has really, really high highs, but it's like, give me a break. It's fine. I think Bloober is, the medium was super well received, and I think that they're a great fit for this. And it's like, it has to be outsourced since Konami is kind of a shadow of its former self. So if you're gonna pick a third party partner to sort of hand over the reins to, which, by the way, like Tina, you said this, it's not confirmed. By the way, we're all just sort of like connecting the dots and making assumptions. Mm-hmm. But I think they're a great candidate for it.
This brings me to another question. What is Konami's, like, what's their strategy? Okay, so like, look at the past few years, ever since Metal Gear Solid 5 and Kojima's departure from the company. First, they were kind of like, well, we're basically out of big budget game development. We're focusing on mobile games. And then they were kind of putting a toe back in. They were releasing retro collections of games like Castlevania on the Nintendo Switch. Mm-hmm. Now they're reviving a Famicom game that never came out in North America. It was recently, a version of it came out on the PC. And now they have this partnership with Bloober. Are they all the way back in? What are they trying to attempt? Like, what are their ambitions here? Do they just go, oh, we can make some money off this, while in addition to our pachinko business and our gym business? Or are they really serious about being a AAA publisher? I have no idea. It's all been so tepid so far in terms of what their actual moves have been in the games industry.
I think
it's wild how big those franchises are, just Metal Gear and Silent Hill alone. Like, that's insane. And then, you know, you have their legacy stuff, Contra and Castlevania and Gradius, and like all these like just beloved things that you would think they could just be making, you know, games and money hand over fist with. But then you go to Japan, you're like, Konami does, as you mentioned, all this other stuff. And, you know, like, it's just shocking to think that they, you know, don't need to be a media company. And this is the biggest, closest thing we've seen to, you know, having, like, if there's going to be a new Silent Hill game, that's like a big single player, giant experience game that they could be edging back into. It would give me hope. But like, I don't know if this seems like an interesting way to go about it. I would love for, you know, Konami to have internal Japanese studios with the people that worked on these amazing games that we still love. But I think those are all just broken up. You know, Kojima leaving there is a pretty big deal. Like, there's lifers at Japanese companies, you know? And so, like, I'm kind of curious what happens. Hey, was there, in the news, there was something about, you mentioned the composer worked on this Bloober game that was a Silent Hill composer.
The Medium.
Yeah, and then he tweeted something we put in our news story, which was like a little hint at like, oh, we have an announcement coming that will be the one you're waiting for or something this summer. I think the pieces are falling in place.
There was a bit of, Kat, you might remember a little bit more specifically than I do, but there was a bit of drama or perceived drama around an interview going up with the composer. And then it was said that, you know, oh, the composer had asked for the interview to be taken down. And then we'd gotten a statement that said, like, no, he didn't ask for the interview to be taken down. But obviously, it's kind of the Streisand effect. Like, anytime there's an assumption around things being taken down, it kind of lends more credence to the rumors. So there was a bit of a roller coaster ride on that story, I think. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that sounds about right, though. I don't remember the specific story that happened. But yeah, like, if they were teasing something that we were going to enjoy this summer, then it absolutely sounds like a Silent Hill thing. As long as we're not having to talk about Blue Box anymore, I'm just happy about that.
Oh, boy. We, you know, Kat, in answer to your question of what is Konami doing, I don't know. It probably has to do with selling more pachinko machines.
Yeah, that's
right.
Tried
and true.
You use video games and to sell pachinko machines.
That's what it all. That's the top of the Konami pyramid at this point.
Yeah. That's the Hear me game. Out.
They should put $100 million into a Gradius sequel. It's time.
You're speaking. Let's my make language. It
happen. So from our news story, it says Silent Hill composer Akira Yamaoka has separately teased that his latest project will be announced this summer, calling it the one you're kind of hoping to hear about.
What could it be?
That would be that. The one.
The one you're kind of hoping to hear about.
But it's absolutely right. Like, you know, fans would clamor for another Silent Hill, so that the pressure is certainly on for that return. And I suppose the pressure is on for Konami in sort of rehabilitating or reestablishing their identity. Because, yes, what is Konami?
When it comes to Silent Hill, I think it's such an interesting franchise because I think that Silent Hill 2, obviously, a classic of survival horror. No doubt about it. But I also think that its reputation has been inflated somewhat by the legend that PT has become. PT has become more of an idea than a game in some ways. And so when people talk about wanting a new Silent Hill, I have to imagine that they want something that combines the innovation slash promise of PT or the idea that of PT that they have in their head with whatever Silent Hill is going to be. And by the way, Kojima has to be working on it. And so anything less than that is going to be like, well, this is what I wanted, you know? So
but that's what I was trying to say earlier. And you all said, oh yeah. No, Justin, watch out.
Justin, why you got to be a hater?
Not from us.
Yeah. I am a little bit of a Silent Hill hater, to be fair.
Oh, geez.
Silent hater. Oh,
don't do that, man.
But I'm just like, it's the same thing you were just saying, though. Like, what game can they make that everyone's like, yep, you did it? Like, they're in a little bit of a tough spot.
This episode of Game Scoop is brought to you by NordVPN. As Scoop Nation knows, your Omega Cops have been a little obsessed with a movie called Weekend at Bernie's lately. But as happens too often these days, it is difficult to find it streaming here in the U.S. That's where NordVPN comes in. With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a more enlightened region where they appreciate the comic delights of Weekend at Bernie's. And it's not just for streaming movies and shows. Switching your virtual location can allow you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, and subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price. And you can do all this worry-free as NordVPN threat protection features protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites. Best of all, NordVPN costs the price of a cup of coffee a month, and one account can be used on up to 6 devices. To get the best discount on your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/gamescoop. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/gamescoop. You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get, except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Well, in non-new acquisitions, collaborations, rumors, news, we have a little bit of news about Elder Scrolls 6, which is that there's not really that much news, essentially. Kat, you actually wrote this story for us, but to catch us up. So the game was announced roughly 3 years ago now, and Todd Howard, the director on the game, came out to say it's good to think of the Elder Scrolls 6 as still being in the design phase, but we're checking the tech. Is this going to handle the things we want to do in that game? Every game will have some new suites of technology, so Elder Scrolls 6 will have some additions to Creation Engine 2 that game is going to require. So of course, you know, their focus right now is on Starfield. That's coming out in 2022, recently shown off during Xbox's E3 conference this year. But it seems like we're a bit of a ways away from some genuine Elder Scrolls 6 news coming up. But I do appreciate the transparency in setting expectations.
Yeah, Elder Scrolls 6 is a long ways away because, I mean, if you think about it, when they announced it back in 2018, they said pre-production. So if you go even further back than that, like say 2016, they're like, we're not working on it right now. It's an idea. It's a thing that we're thinking about. So 2018, pre-production, they're still like sketching it out, I guess. They're still figuring out the technology. And they said in the interview that it's going to use the Creation Engine 2, which we got a glimpse of in the Starfield teaser. It looks like, frankly, really good new technology. I was actually quite impressed with what they showed in the Starfield teaser. And so we're going to get that in Elder Scrolls 6. They said that they're going to continue to push the technology forward with it. They have a lot of very ambitious ideas for Elder Scrolls 6. They're going to use photogrammetry to be able to get actual extras in. I think they said that they're going to have Skyrim grandma in Elder Scrolls 6, which is pretty cool. And they're going to have a really big world, you know? So whatever eventually comes out is probably going to be absolutely mind-blowing, but Bethesda has never made any bones about the fact that they were focusing on Starfield. They're going to get Starfield out, and then it was going to be on to the next thing. And that was Elder Scrolls 6. And if anything, I think they said that there was another project as well as Elder Scrolls 6, which may actually come out before that as well. So frankly, it doesn't seem like Bethesda's in any hurry, because actually Skyrim is still selling really well.
Yeah.
10 yep, years yeah. later. You could play Skyrim on your fridge and probably a million people will buy it as long as it has mods.
Yeah. I mean, why? What's their thought process for announcing it? Like, why put that logo out there?
They
like,
wanted some hype.
But like, why? Like, what do they get? Like, you don't need, like, Nintendo doesn't need to say Mario will return. Like, we know. Like,
yeah, but they will. Think about all the speculation and the hype that's been going on for the past 3 years around Elder Scrolls 6. It's still front of mind in the Elder Scrolls community. They're going, well, maybe it's going to be called Redfall. It could be Redfall. It's going to be Redfall. It doesn't turn out to be Redfall, but people are just talking about it. People are looking at the Starfield trailer and going, aha, we have found it. It's definitely going to be in Hammerfell based on this tiny etching on a dashboard on the spaceship.
I love that story.
In Starfield.
I mean, and that's the thing.
People are talking about it.
Mm-hmm. It feels like similar to Elden Ring in the sense of if you don't say something about it, the community will find something to say about it for you, contributing to speculation and then possibly contributing to raised, heightened expectations that who knows if you can deliver on them at that point. That's why transparency is good. It's my motto.
It's going to be almost 20 years between Elder Scrolls games.
That's wild, isn't it?
that's insane. Yeah, I was looking up like their Elder Scrolls publishing schedule, and there's about 4 years between the development. They said they started after Oblivion developing Skyrim, and Skyrim was out. So that was about 4 years that took. Games take close to longer than that now, because especially really ambitious ones. But if they're that early, maybe we can look for 2 or 3 years still to go. What's interesting when you look at that schedule, though, of published Elder Scrolls games, is that it's like it's Skyrim, and then it's Online, and then it's Blades, right? And you compare that, like, that's barely anything for like the biggest, kind of just like with Konami, like just this big property that they own, this big like series of games that they own. It's just not that much. And like what Nintendo does between Zeldas is they like remake 3 Zeldas, or they put off spin-off Zeldas and stuff like that. And like, I'm just shocked at how little comes out from that lucrative franchise, taking into account that, as Kat pointed out, Skyrim just sells anyway, so they just don't need to. I'm still surprised. I mean, I would love a Oblivion remake. That was like all I could think about when I was like, why aren't they just giving us some things like morsels like Nintendo does, between things? It'd be super cool.
No, you're going to take your remastered Skyrim and you're going to like it.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
But they did release play it on your Texas Instrument.
They did release Fallout 76 and Elder Scrolls Online, They're still putting out new games. It's not like they haven't done anything since Fallout 4.
No, it's just like that universe. Games,
they're not exploiting the Elder Scrolls universe. There's not a million tie-in novels coming out or like that. I think that's what you're getting at, Sam. For it to still have prominence.
Granted, the MMO
does,
is
just
like
leaving it alone.
Yeah, exactly.
But less is more, if they just exploit it, people are like, oh, here we go. Bethesda's just trying to milk the Elder Scrolls dragon or something until it's dry.
The Aurochs.
This is keeping the excitement high. I think the comparison point is, if you look at the difference, the time that we had to wait between Fallout 3 and Fallout 4, the production of Fallout 4 started in like 2008, and Fallout 4 finally came out in 2015. And it took, so that's a solid 7 years. So if you think about it, basically Elder Scrolls 6 production started in about 2018, or not even production, pre-production. So if you're like going by 7 years, like 2025?
Yeah, and my example from before that was 4 years. So it's probably a graph. So it's like 4, then 7, and then what, 11 next?
Games take a long time to make now, you know? Yeah. Like, especially totally a game like that.
So. And building, you know, like, it's 20 years is an exaggeration, by the way. It's going to be probably about 15 years between Elder Scrolls games. But like, when it's on a whole new tech stack, like, you know, top to bottom, we built new tech. It's like, it's not actually a horrible idea to like test it and build it for your new thing. And then it's sort of there and established, and you have that foundation with which to do, like, you can't mess up an Elder Scrolls game. Like, they have to deliver a home run with it. So maybe it's better to build the new tech for Starfield and then layer on what they need for Elder Scrolls, which they talked about in their interview recently.
Don't you think Microsoft is going to have something to say about this too? They can be like, listen, we're going to close Windows, we're going to close Skype, and we're just going to work on Elder Scrolls.
Yeah. Turn off Slack for a little bit.
Yeah.
Xbox has Avowed and Fable and a million other first-person open-world RPGs, and they're going to put them out every year. They're establishing a cadence. It's going to happen. So they're going to have Outer Worlds 2, Avowed, whatever, the Brian Fargo-owned studio that I can never remember their name, who did Wasteland 3. You'll have their game. They're also making a first person, like, Microsoft set. So Bethesda can take their time.
Well, you know, the fact that I have sort of a conspiracy theory, which is that Microsoft bought Obsidian, right? And Obsidian used to lock themselves up with Bethesda, and they used to make, you know, they made Fallout New Vegas, which now Microsoft owns. And so we're in a world, all the pieces are set for Obsidian to make a Fallout game, I guess, is what I'm getting at. There's nothing, like, Microsoft owns them both. You know, they own Fallout and they owned Obsidian.
What must the meetings between Bethesda and Obsidian be like? Because there are some pretty gnarly rumors about the relationships between those studios. I would love to be on a fly on a wall when Todd Howard and Fergus Urquhart are getting together around a table and saying, "Oh, hello." Mm-hmm.
But they have the same mom and dad now. So,
yep,
can't fight anymore.
Nope.
Well, perfect transition into the next topic. Is outside of the news, our own news. What are we playing, everybody? I'll start first. I'm playing Mass Effect Legendary Edition. I alluded to this last week. I'm not planning on playing anything else until I am done with Mass Effect 3. I'm just about there. Because if I stop now to play Ratchet and Clank, I'll never play anything else ever again. Or I'll never play any Mass Effect ever again. So personally, I have really been enjoying the, like, almost turn-based strategy gameplay that you can force Mass Effect into, that you can kind of recreate by using the weapon and the power wheel. It's incredibly, I kind of forgot how adaptable and fun it's always been, and I it's been interesting to see playing back to back. I never really noticed the pattern of the evolution of some of, like, the UI or even the map, or rather the lack thereof evolution between the map, or even how, like, quests are logged just between the different series. It's just really interesting to see the different directions that they took, and then comparing that with the engagement of your squad mates. Like, I felt like in Mass Effect 1 there were more random dialogue moments because you could directly engage with your squad mates, kind of like a bit of a Dragon Age effect, where they're just chatting around you while you're going about your quests. And then, of course, in 2 and 3, you do get the more in-depth relationships, at the very least. But it's this evolution of, like, seeing Mass Effect as a series through that has, like, given me this, like, reappreciation for some of these things and helped me see, like, the developers walking through, like, BioWare kind of evolving through as they go through and identify, like, what really makes the experience unique, what really strikes for people. And then just recalling that, oh, Mass Effect 1 was just not a good game. Let's just
put it out there. Tina!
I was Tina. So with you. I was so with you right up there till the
debate,
very end.
Debate me.
I'm calling the cops.
How about
you've left me no choice.
Look, I'm going to give my spiel for the original Mass Effect really quickly. It gets so freaking good once you leave the Citadel for the first time. It's the most expansive of the original Mass Effect games. It's the most ambitious. It has a heck of a set piece to close off. It has the best villain. And frankly, like, I don't think that Mass Effect 2 or 3 works if Mass Effect 1 doesn't establish that foundation so well. It's under so much pressure to build this universe, and it's really great. And frankly, it's the deepest out of all of them, because Mass Effect 2 and 3 are just glorified shooters. So,
wow.
Just what I'm going to say.
That is a fair point, that they do dive more into the gameplay, which, to be fair, is going to be the more like mainstreamy appeal thing. And everything in 2 and 3 really truly does build off of the events in 1. So it is important if you want to carry out your own unique decisions. So I personally... like some people have been saying, skip 1 if you're doing Legendary Edition.
No,
skip 1.
Don't skip 1.
Go straight to... I agree.
I skipped 1. I skipped it. I played comic book.
So, yeah, you can make, like, you can make certain decisions, but there is a lot more depth when you kind of go through. It just felt very like, let me get on my Mako again, and let me go across this planet I'm suddenly in a collector mindset, no pun intended, where I need to go and find every single thing on every one of these planets. So like, that got less grueling in 2 and 3, so that was a good evolution in that direction. But it was important, because you have certain dynamics with certain characters that come to play even in 3, even 2 games later, like significant little dialogue moments. Like, you'll have a moment in 2 where you meet Jack, and if you, or in 3 where you meet Jack again, and if you had done something unique with her, if you had chosen her for a specific mission role, then she has something to say about it in 3. Like, that carry through of the development of the impact of like all the relationships that truly do feel unique to you make me feel like you have to play 1. But comparatively, I just felt like it was a lot more grueling to get all of that at the end of the day.
Don't skip 1. I'm biting
my tongue.
Are we not
Don't
friends
skip
anymore,
1. Because if you skip 1, you just can't build the connections to the party members that will make you genuinely love them when they come around in Mass Effect 2. And I think those connections are what make Mass Effect special.
What were you saying, Sam?
Oh, it's like I skipped 1. So like, the reason I did is because I played it before and I don't want to play it ever again. I probably played it twice before. I don't know. Like, that game, like, even the second time, I worked on the guide for this game, so that always flavors my memories of it and how things go with it. But I do remember it being a bit of a slog, but I also remember it being gorgeous and world building, and I love the characters and everything about that. I just didn't ever want to play it again. But that could be totally also, you know, because I was like, I wrote a book this thick about this game, and I'm done with it. I'm just done.
Hey, if you played it before and did the guide for it, respect, Sam. Like, you've earned a pass. You can skip it. It's okay.
But 2 was really fun to go back and play, and like, I love it. I think it's so great to hop into, and especially with the DLC, it's like been really cool playing that like with characters that you unlock from the start, and it's so fun.
And I will say, Mass Effect 3, by comparison, I actually feel like I need a guide to get through that game. Because there's certain elements, like, you'll miss out on certain missions, certain side quests, if you don't complete them before certain priority quests. And there's no real way to know that unless you get into a good routine and habit of, okay, I'll do a priority quest, then I'll do all the planet scanning I can do before the Reapers are coming after me. And then I'll do all the side quests I can possibly do. And then I'll probably be safe to go to the next priority mission where I'm not messing anything up. But then if you miss items, no one tells you can go to like the Spectre Requisitions office and go and buy. Like, there's a lot that you have to figure out on the fly or read about. And so that was to the detriment of 3, I would say. Like, 1 and 2 felt a lot like they made more sense in that sense. But 1, to come back to like the relationships element, you do have this like good side dialogue when you're going, when you take, you know, the Mako out and you're out with your companions. You do have more side dialogue there. But when you're on the ship, when you're back on the Normandy, it's very limited. And I didn't remember how limited it was, because when I think about Mass Effect, I realize, like, I kind of consider Mass Effect 2 and Mass Effect 1 in my memory like the same game, a one continuous structure. And I didn't realize how Mass Effect 1 was very much like the bare bones. You're right, Kat, like the foundation, 100%, both in terms of what plays out in the rest of the story, but also what the identity of Mass Effect is. Everything is rooted in 1, so it's important in that sense. But I when I went back, I realized, like, I thought there was a lot more depth to 1 than I'm remembering now.
So you don't do any of the walking around the ship and, like, developing your relationships between missions in 1?
You do. Not nearly as much. Mm. You do, but, like... Like Dr. Chakwas, you say one thing to her and she has nothing to say the rest of the game, for instance. Granted, she's a side character regardless in 2 and 3 too, but there are more moments with her as the series goes on. So they start to develop even those side characters a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, 2 is really focused on that. Like even the first, like, I've played like 10 hours of it again, and it's like most of my time has been obsessively making sure I've done all my dialogue options and making sure the characters I like know I like them. And like that's all happening on the ships. Like, I'm barely on planets sometimes, and I'm just like, my entire play session was walking around the ship.
Please like me so you don't die.
Yeah,
yep, exactly.
It's the power of friendship this that we're saves seeing them. Right now. This was the miserable experience that we're seeing right now. Yes. I had to do everything.
Yeah, but
I felt like I needed
like going around scanning planets in Mass Effect 2.
It's true. Yeah. I'll give you that one.
And just don't do it.
But you have to scan the planets in Mass Effect 2.
You don't have to do any of this in 1.
You got to get in 3, you got to get your war assets. In 2, you got to get all of the resources so that none of your people die, because you got to fortify that ship. And I did not do that the first time I played, so I was more than happy to redo all of that this time around.
I'm playing through Legendary Edition and Mass Effect right now as well, kind of slowly and steadily, because I did take a break for Ratchet and Clank. And like, I just, you know, I've always liked them. Like, who doesn't like the Mass Effect games? But like, my esteem and opinion of them has only gone up in this replay. And I think BioWare got done dirty a little bit, because Mass Effect 3 was a little bit rushed. They didn't have the time to do what they wanted to do with that game. And then the final 10 minutes of that game really colored people's opinion of the whole trilogy. And like, going back through it with fresh eyes, it is an unbelievable achievement in world building and lore, and a marriage of narrative and meaningful player choice and gameplay and everything in that game world. Like, Mass Effect 2 has ammo and 1 doesn't, and there's an in-game explanation why that's actually logical and makes sense, and how the technology works. Like, it's unbelievable. It's an absolute milestone. And when 1 came out, like, that was early-ish days for, like, 3D, you know, cover-based RPGs. Like, everything else was not at that level. And then 2 came out right after it, like 2 years later. And then 3 was 2 years later. Like, they did not have a lot of time to just sprint through the making of this trilogy. And I don't know, like, I think that this replay has really shown me that these are some of my favorite games of all time, which I didn't really quite understand or I didn't feel that way when I went through them the first time around when they were contemporary. I don't think it's fair to compare the Mass Effect games and the player choice that goes into them to something like The Witcher, when it's so much more extensive and thorough, and the permutations of who's alive and who's dead and how they had to account for that in Mass Effect 3. It's on a completely different level than what anyone else is even attempting to do, let alone sort of following through and managing to largely execute successfully like BioWare did. It's incredible. In my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, Justin. And actually, the way that Mass Effect is talked about kind of reminds me of how people talk about Neon Genesis Evangelion, an anime that was hailed as groundbreaking when it came out, but people are like, I don't know about that ending. And then it became kind of a meme, and people were kind of goofing on it for a long time as it became largely unavailable and hard to watch. And then it got a re-release, and everybody returned to it at exactly the same time. And in many ways, it boosted its reputation again. People who are like, I really hated that ending, maybe still hated the ending, but go, like, man, what a cool game. And I feel like people are saying the same thing about Mass Effect Legendary Edition.
Legendary Edition is good.
People talk about the big stuff, right? Like, what you do about the Genophage, or what you do about, just the other major choices in the game. But, like, there's so much tiny stuff. There's so much tiny, cool stuff that in 2... you meet a character that they're like, oh, thank you so much for saving me. Like, you saved my life. And like, that reactive nature of the gameplay in even tiny, small ways is they don't get enough credit for that, for how many flags and how much stuff was carried over game to game. And then the through line through, you know, the war asset stuff is like a little bit cheesy. It makes it real very gamey, but it gives these small storylines a through line and a little punctuation mark at the end of your adventure that that I really appreciate.
And we're never going to see a game like the Mass Effect trilogy ever again. Like, nobody is going to go and try and make that kind of experience ever again. It's one of a kind. And so I'm just grateful that we got the Mass Effect trilogy, even if it didn't quite stick the landing, it's still an incredible series.
What if we get the trilogy again in 10 years, 20 years, but they just change the text to be really, really tiny and crappy looking and hard to read?
Just make it a bad font, like the pixel remaster, Final Fantasy pixel remasters.
Oh no, the font thing. Oh jeez.
The joke.
Yeah, you know, Kat, you're right. Like, I almost have this sense of melancholy playing through them where it's like, holy shit, like, and this isn't a knock against BioWare. Like, I hope that they're back and Mass Effect 4 is really, really good. But even if it is good, 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 game, I don't think there's any chance that they're going to do the reactive nature of, like, the permutations and how they branched from 2 to 3 and just got wider and wider. Like, I think they and the rest of the video game industry learned a lot of lessons in the Mass Effect trilogy that are never to be repeated, in my opinion. I hope I'm wrong, but it's like, it does feel like lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, the original Mass Effect was very much the product of a young, maybe slightly crazy studio that had all of these big, bold ideas and somehow pulled off a lot of them. And maybe by Mass Effect 3, they were going, what have we done? Oh my God, we cannot possibly bring this all around. And, you know, BioWare has changed a lot as a studio since then.
And they did it in a condensed time frame too, which I definitely have a sense of, like, what could have been, where, you know, EA, and, you know, to EA's credit, like, games got to come out. You got to release your game. But, like, they didn't really give BioWare the time that they needed. And it's kind of a miracle that Mass Effect 3 exists in as high quality a state as it does, even if it doesn't completely deliver on everything.
So, Kat, I want to hear about what you've been playing too, but before, you mentioned that Mass Effect 1 had the best villain, so which one? Because there was a few of those.
Oh my God, you're going to make me try and remember his name. Is it Barriss? Is that his name? He shoots himself in the head. Gosh darn it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, Saren, there you go. Saren, see, I'm being exposed as a fraud gamer because I couldn't remember the name off the top of my head. I just did because a two-hour podcast about this as well for my own show, so I should remember it off the top of my head. I guess I'm getting old, but no, Saren's great. He is a villain that holds through the entire game all the way up until the end, the final confrontation. It's really enjoyable. It has its roots going back to the original Fallout 2, Fallout 1, when you meet the Master and you can basically convince him to kill himself. That's like hardcore, good old school RPG stuff right there. And I mean, Mass Effect 2 was much more of a nebulous villain, right? I guess you could say that the Cerberus and the Smoky Man. No, not the Smoky Man.
The Elusive Man.
I cannot remember.
The Elusive Man.
The Elusive Man. Yeah, like he's the villain in that one in many ways. But Saren, best villain.
Complicated, like a lot of the decisions in the narrative in the series.
Yeah.
But yes, Kat, let us know. What are you playing?
I have been playing the Monster Hunter Stories 2 demo, and this game is unlikely to get a lot of attention, but the TLDR of it is basically it's Monster Hunter, but by way of Pokemon, which I think is kind of neat. It's a very pretty game, and basically it kind of posits a theory that I've been kind of thinking about for a while, which is maybe the hunters in Monster Hunter are actually the villains. Maybe they're actually bad. Maybe we should not be killing these monsters. Perhaps the monsters should be our friends. Because Monster Hunter Stories 2, you live on an island, you're pals with the monsters, you ride them around, they're the best. And then some jerk hunters come along and are trying to kill a Rathalos, and this messes up the entire ecosystem, and you're chastising those hunters. And it just tells me that you were bad all along in the Monster Hunter games. But Monster Hunter Stories 2, I find the art style a little bit overbearing. It's very cutesy. Kind of cel-shady game. They actually tried to mature it a little bit. And you can go read Jesse Wade's interview with the Monster Hunter Story 2 devs over on IGN. But kind of reminds me of Yo-Kai Watch a little bit in terms of the actual art style. But The battle system is actually quite good. It has a kind of a rock, paper, scissor situation going on. And it feels like Monster Hunter only in a turn-based combat kind of sense. And you can recruit monsters, have them fighting along your side. It's like, remember, monsters are friends, not food.
But, oh, hold on. Okay. So the premise here is that it's bad to hunt monsters, basically poach monsters for their parts. But
I wouldn't say that it's that's the premise. It's just that hunters come along and mess everything up, like the jerks that they are. So this is for
saying,
the people who are.
It makes you reflect on it, right?
Yeah.
However, the thing they're settling on is animals are your friends, so let's make them fight each other, which is just dog fighting or cock fighting.
Yeah. Right? Well, no. They're just. They're protecting you or something. I don't know. Don't make me think about this too much.
This is like Pokemon. If you look too far into it, you're like, this is messed up.
Yeah.
This is when it starts to get kind of dark. It does make me think about, like, on the Pokemon connection, it does make me think about how everybody wants their own Pokemon, but nobody can quite land it. And that's because Pokemon, just for as cute as it is always secretly a little bit dark and a little bit weird. And no game can quite hit that kind of weird darkness in the same way as Game Freak can. And I'm not sure that Monster Hunter Stories 2 can either, but... I think it's going to be one of those sneaky, under the radar, pretty good RPGs when it comes out on Nintendo Switch.
That's great. You're right about that undercurrent in the Monster Hunter games, though. Like, frequently the monsters are asleep when you initiate combat with them, and I'm like, this isn't great.
They're just wandering around, minding their own business.
You're
enjoying
their
lives.
Just in their ecosystem.
Yeah,
that's a decision in Mass Effect several times, right? Is to not only commit xenocide on aliens, but to choose whether or not to kill the fauna.
Yeah. You have to spare the Arachnid Queen. And I should say Monster Hunter has the thinnest justification for, like, there is some in-game reason why you're killing all these monsters, because they're messing up the world or whatever, but
they're messing up the ecosystem. We gotta balance it out or something. No, then, you're just gonna go around
that's what hunters say.
And then wear their skin.
Could be true.
But Sam, some monsters do deserve to be killed with fire because they're just that terrifying.
Because they're full of fire and they're emitting it.
Yes. There are some monsters where you're just like, you jerk, you are dead. I have killed you. Thank God. So, and when you're carving them up, you carve them up with relish.
Fire with fire. I like it. Sam, what are you playing these days?
Oh, boy. So usually Damon gives me like a stop clock so I can know when to stop talking about pinball. So I'm not going to do that this time. So I'm just like maybe 15, 20 minutes. I'm just joking, but we have at the arcade that I have games at here in town, got the new Mandalorian machine. It's cool. If we were in the office right now, we could all probably be playing this. Maybe we will soon, but it's based on Mando. It's from Stern. So you can see here, there's like a Boba Fett, Mandalorian head, like mini play field is one of the things in it. It's got like a couple of cool, very steep ramps. Those are kind of the features. It's very plain features wise. And there's some stuff that I don't like that I'm gonna start out talking about with it. One of the things is that big plastic Baby Yoda in the background just does nothing. It's just there. You know, there's no like cool thing for it to be. It's just kind of an ugly big toy in the background. But the game has really easy to hit shots, and that's nice about it. But the thing I really like about it, and the thing that is super worth checking out for, is that it has a full theme integration. You watch clips from the show, and it has like really good sound and like full, just like, and the reason like to point that out is like plenty of games don't do that. Like you play Deadpool, it has nothing from the Deadpool movies in it. It's like all like made for pinball animations, and they're like not amazing. That game's a little bit better than others, but like I really like how this has like full television integration into it. And so it's like when you lose the ball, like the whole theme of balls in this game is the eggs that Grogu is going for in the show.
That's great.
And so like when you like tilt or you're draining or whatever, it's like Grogu's like grabbing one of those eggs and eating it. It's really fun. And so they do a lot of good integration with that. But that's basically it. I've been playing it, and I only played it a couple of nights this week, but I can't wait to go back and try more. It's very new pinball machines are rare, so it's very exciting. That's my rant.
I think pinball is kind of my favorite thing, really. It's like when I go to an arcade, I make a beeline for the pinball machines because they're always just such a fresh and enjoyable experience. And I happen to live near the Alabama pinball machine pinball museum.
Oh,
so
man.
I can go there anytime.
It's such
I want.
A great place.
And amazing. Just a wonderful, one of my favorite places in the entire Bay Area.
That place is great because they divide up rooms by era. So you walk through the old timey room and just keep walking. But there's an 80s room and like a 90s room, and like they swap out games enough in them. And there's like a jukebox in each one with like the era's music in that you are free to like put on stuff. And it's so smart, and it's such a great like cool vibe there. And I think they're getting a new space too. They're really working hard on it. It might be like an old museum down there is the latest I heard.
And Justin, you're playing Mass Effect Legendary Edition too, you said?
Yes, I shared my impassioned speech. He's getting more and more worked up as you two are bagging on Mass Effect 1.
there's some
Justin,
good elements.
I'm with you.
I think we represented both the flaws and the positives of that game.
We have no tiebreaker here. It's 2-2. So
that's true. Yeah.
Stuff.
The climax of that game, from like Vermeier into Ilos and then into the assault on the Citadel, is like unmatched in its marriage of like, you know, gameplay and narrative stakes, and also payoff of personal story moments with Rex. Like, it's such a masterclass. It's so well done. And just don't land on the random planets. Just don't do it. Pass
yeah,
it on.
Just don't get any of those. Just don't get any of those items.
You don't need them. You gotta get one of those floating orbs.
Thresher Maw is an iconic part of Mass Effect. I remember
they're just
that
sleeping.
Name.
They're just sleeping.
That's actually a good
one. And they play a bigger role down the road.
Yeah. Thresher Maws are are friends, not food.
Another example. That's true, actually. No spoilers. But yes, it is time for 20 questions, everybody. Oh, our suggestion this week comes from Chris W. from Eagle Pass, Texas. My neighbor, hello.
Wow.
Let the questioning begin.
That's not actually your neighbor, though, right? You're just
well. I mean, yeah, I'm in Texas right now, so
no. Yes, understood. Technically, but you don't
city
know
neighbors.
This person.
No. We did not collude over this.
Got it.
and then is the basic premise of video game 20 questions? You're all caught up on that, Kat? Basically,
no,
we
I'm not.
We ask
I'm
joke
like, this
questions.
Is all, this is all special. This is all new to me, so I'm excited
okay.
about this.
Whoops.
Okay. So yes or no questions. Now.
Yeah.
20 yes or no questions, and we have some go-tos. We usually try to narrow things down by like era, and then like like region and developer and stuff like that. But like that doesn't work always, and so it'll get interesting. So I don't want to influence your questioning at all.
Yeah.
And we'll do our best to get there. And we have some new tricks, and one of the newest ones did not work at all last week. And so I'd like to try it again this week. And that's where I asked multiple genres in one. But it worked on some weeks prior. So I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it to kick off.
One clarification. It's actually 19 questions and a guess.
Oh, right. That's good.
Isn't it?
It's all a lie. Yes. 19 questions.
I know.
You have to, the last question, whenever you get to it, even if it's not 19 or if you're not 20, has to be, is this game?
Yes. It's Jeopardy rules. Like, what is insert game here?
Yeah. We should learn by doing.
Okay.
We should just go.
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, so is this an RPG, an action game, or a shooter?
No.
Oh. All right, well, you eliminated three genres.
Great. Did this video game come out in the 90s originally, like on its first release?
Yes.
Is this game on a PlayStation console?
No.
Is this game a platformer, a puzzle game, or a fighter?
Yes.
I hate this. I instantly hate this, right? Five questions in.
Well, we know it's a platformer, a puzzle game, or a fighter. That's what we know now. Period.
Okay. Was this game originally released on a Nintendo platform?
Yes, that's five.
Was this game released in Japan first?
No, actually. That's
okay.
Six.
Japan first
check.
Is really interesting. We usually ask where it was developed, but knowing which country it came out in first is an interesting spin on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I looked this up earlier to make sure. Let me confirm. Yep. The answer was no.
Does it feature a popular mascot? That's like,
no, I wouldn't say that. That's seven, right? Am I keeping track well?
But then it's like, it's so sad. It's like, is Vector Man considered popular? I guess it's on Nintendo platform, but...
Mm-hmm.
We don't know if it's on NES, Super Nintendo, 64, Virtual Boy. This
no, but we know it was a
or
90s
Game Boy.
Game
Boy Advance.
Yeah. It's a 90s game.
Oh,
it's on a Nintendo platform. It came out here first, or it did not come out in Japan first. So that's like really interesting.
Uncommon.
Does it have 2D graphics?
Yes.
That was yes?
Yeah, we lost your audio, but I saw you nod.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I want to get it out of the way. Did it come out? Did this game originally come out on the Super Nintendo?
No.
Ooh, what?
Okay. So we've removed the Super Nintendo from the equation.
But it is a 2D game.
Was this a handheld game?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So NES or maybe a 2D game on 64.
Yeah. I mean, 90s. Yeah, we got to pick one.
Is this based on a license?
Yes.
It's based on a license.
Is it NES? An NES game?
Yes.
Okay, so an NES game based on a license. Probably a platformer.
Okay.
From that question.
What were the three genres? Platformer, puzzle, or... We don't fighting. Even know. We don't remember. Fighting. Yeah.
I remember. Okay. That's the hardest part of that question, though. I will admit that.
Remembering what you asked, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the hardest part of just Game Scoop, is remembering what you said.
That's true. It's just like a blackout right after.
And it was not released in North America first. My first thought was the McDonald's platformer.
That's what I was just going to say, McKids.
Yeah, McKids, right?
That's great.
It could totally be McKids, right? I don't know if it came out in the 90s.
That game was...
What about Yo-Noid?
Yeah, Yo-Noid.
Could be Yo-Noid.
But it's funny because you asked if there was a popular mascot in it. And the answer was no.
Noid is not popular.
Take that, Noid.
That's true.
Noid's back.
What about the California Raisins?
Yeah, it never came out, though. Yeah.
They were incredibly popular, though.
Yeah, that's true. Let's go with... Okay, is this based on a franchise or a movie? A movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's based on a movie. Okay. It on the NES... It's like a platformer or something.
I mean, they made made Home Alone games. They made a million of them.
Totally. Oh, is this based on a movie that's live action, not cartoon?
Is it based on a live action? No.
No.
Okay. Not live action.
Oh.
Okay.
Interesting.
I mean, there's
14. There's
a cartoon.
Simpsons.
Oh yeah, like Bart versus the Spaceman. But that's popular.
That's not movie. Movie.
Good point.
Should we ask about Disney or
Disney? Disney Afternoon.
How many NES ones are there though? In the 90s,
quite a few.
Okay. DuckTales.
DuckTales 2.
Yeah.
Chippendale Rescue Ranger. That would have been 1990.
But none of those are movies. It's based off an animated movie that has to be from like 90 or 91.
Well, there's Lion King, Aladdin, Little Mermaid. Beauty and the Beast.
So Aladdin and Lion King were not on Nintendo.
That's
on,
They're on NES. They're from Virgin, but they were just really late and like nobody played them.
Really? I didn't know that.
Like the Little Mermaid would be a good one. That also. Yeah.
Well, did we establish whether or not this was Disney?
No, we didn't. You want to ask that one?
Is this a Disney property?
Nope.
Not Disney.
Boy. That's speculation for nothing.
So Nickelodeon? You guys have. Four more and a guess.
Fern Gully.
What? Are you counting right?
Yeah, that was 15.
I'm trying to think about early 90s. Like, what did Justin go see in the movie theater when I was a little kid?
What if it's not animation, but like stop animation or puppetry, like Muppets or something? Now that'd be live action, I guess. That'd all be live action.
Was there a Nickelodeon game on the NES?
Bunch of Ren and Snippy games.
There were Ren and Snippy games?
Yeah, but they're not based on movies. They're based on a show. Buckaroos is one of them. One's just called Ren Snippy. I think there's three.
Okay.
But we can ask. I just can't think of another Nickelodeon. Like, seriously, like, animated movies.
Animated movies.
Who was making movies back then, besides Disney?
And, okay, so... Yeah, and it's like Western animation.
It's like
Five
Old Goes West and All Dogs Go to Heaven type movies, but those weren't.
Yeah.
They didn't make NES games out of those.
No.
Is it Western animation?
I was just going to say that. Thank you for the hint. Just because the came out here first.
Oh.
It still it could still be based off of, you know, I don't know, Akira or something, like something.
Yeah. There's Little Nemo.
Dream Master. Yeah, Little Nemo.
Little Nemo.
No, but that would have totally not come out in the United States before it came out in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
I don't know.
Is this a Capcom game?
Yes.
Oh, Capcom. Okay.
It's 16.
I mean, I guess that's what it is. Is this about dreams?
Yes, that's 17.
I love this game so much. You want to do the honors, Kat?
Is it Little Nemo, the Dream Master?
Yes.
Nice.
I felt like I had to throw out a little bit of a tip.
You totally hinted us in.
It was a little bit more hard mode than I was expecting because, yes, it was released in North America on September 16th, 1990, and then in Japan in December, so a few months following. Yeah. So I think that may have thrown things off a little bit, yeah.
That's a cool fact, though. Mm-hmm, and, that's with, you know, knowledge of these games and stuff, that's actually a really good question for us to have.
I looked up the IGN coverage that we did not review it, so there's still a chance. We don't exactly have a guide page. We do have a cheats page written by Samuel Claiborne himself.
Oh, really? You did a cheats page for that? That's hardcore, Sam.
I'm a big fan. and then we used to play this at our desk a lot. Game that, like, before the office shut down, that a friend of the show and a parent on the show, CJ, would insist that he could beat. He insisted he could beat this game. And he would come over and he'd play it for a long time and not beat it. And to this day, he's never beat it. So we'll see. It gets hard. I love
it. Apparently it ramps up quite a bit. Yeah. I was hoping that you guys would go down the line of, like, you know, do you shoot weapons and whatnot? Because I genuinely watched an entire walkthrough for this game in preparation of 20 questions to make sure I could answer every question. And I was hoping we would go down the weapon path because turns out you do not have a weapon until you get to the end for the boss fights. You get a Morning Star. It shoots out beams. It's specifically for the boss fights. Otherwise, you throw candy at animals like a frog and a mole to take on their costume and be able to use their abilities around the map, as you guys saw in the B-roll. But regardless, that is all the scoops that we have for you this week. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Kat. Thank you, Damon, for letting me host in your absence, Damon. And of course, thank you to Marian working behind the scenes. And thank you to everyone who emailed in 20 question submissions and topic suggestions. We didn't get to check in with the listeners on today's episode. So Justin, I'm going to need you to go ahead and say hi anyway, because it's tradition. So Justin, if you will.
Got it. Hey, listeners.
There you go. Thank you very much. Don't forget, you can email gamescoop@ign.com with more suggestions for our next 20 questions selection for next week. This has been IGN Game Scoop, and we're out.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.